That's right. You have to make that decision. That's right. That's what we're here about today. People need to make these decisions in a way that makes a difference. It makes a difference in the world. It makes a difference in the future of humanity. Okay? This is the kind of stuff that we're dealing with today. So you know when you come to this show each and every week, that's what we're going to be wrestling with, and that's what you're going to be thinking about, and that's what you're going to be helping us dig into. This show today, I'm really looking forward to this. I look forward to every show, but this one is actually, I'm really looking forward to it. In the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with Talila Lewis, an attorney, organizer, and educator who helps people understand the inextricable links between racism, classism, ableism, and structural inequity. She recently wrote that Trump's rule attacking disabled and low-income migrants has a violent history, and everyone should know about it and stand up around it. All right? So that's going to be at the back end of the show. Before that, we'll be listening to a piece from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, from the film Revolution and Religion, The Fight for Emancipation and the Role of Religion, a dialogue between Cornel West and Bob Avakian. And opening the show up, I'm really pleased to be bringing on to the show, and I think this may be the first time you've been on the show, right?
I've been on a couple times, but
come on,
long time ago.
See, he's telling me, "Yo, you're getting old, man." All right, I'm really pleased to be welcoming to the show Rafael Cadaris, and he's from the Revolution Club, the Revolution Tour, and he works with Rev Books in Berkeley. And we're here to talk about something that's recently happened in Berkeley around the Revolution Books. And I want to let people know that this interview was recorded prior to the weekend march of fascists, Proud Boys, and neo-Nazis that we'll be speaking about. But the battle is far from over, and the points my guest brings out are things everyone should be thinking about. So, Rafael, why don't we there's a piece that we can play in the beginning, right? Because this is, you could set it up and then we'll play the piece.
Yeah, so thanks for having me on, Michael. Just to give people a sense, this Sunday there's this fascist group that's actually called for marching on Revolution Books in Berkeley. It's part of their No to Marxism protest. They're calling out Revolution Books as a communist anti-American bookstore, which, by the way, it is. And we'll talk a little bit more about what Revolution Books is all about. But this is part of a whole pattern of attacks on Revolution Books going back the last couple years. And we can put it a little bit more in context. But I thought we could start first by listening to actually one of the most recent attacks on Revolution Books. We have some audio, and you can hear these people actually threatening to burn down Revolution Books. And people should just think about what that actually conjures up, the image of book burning, you know, of Nazis assaulting a bookstore in Berkeley and threatening to burn it down. So if we could play that clip.
I'm a racist because I support our president of this United States of America?
Yes, basically, yes.
You are so ignorant. That is the
commie scum.
Yes, give me a good reason.
You're commie scum. We're going to burn down your bookstore. You know.
Give me a fucking good reason.
Okay, we have you on recorded that you say you're going to burn down our bookstore.
You Marxist, judgmental pieces of You can't tell us how to live. This is America.
Are burning books.
Please leave now.
This is America. You. This is a public thing. Why don't you go in there and start?
Please leave now. You're not allowed in our store.
I already
go
said
now.
No. I'm not going in your fucking store. So get the fuck out of my face. And this motherfucker wants to fucking do it. Yeah, you motherfucker. I was here March 4th, April 15th, April 27th. We ran your stupid asses out of the fucking Berkeley. Trump is going to get rid of all you fucking pieces of You know that? Oh, you anti-American.
Hey, you know what? Your genocide is coming. Your genocide.
They're half say make America great again.
Hell yeah.
And you can tell that what this really means is make America white again.
Hey, Revolution Books, the only people that come here
and
to buy
further,
this
we don't
are a team of pieces
here. White supremacists and fascists are not welcome at Revolution Books.
All right, Rafael, let's dig into this. I just want to, you know, because it's, look, there's this whole point that's made there. I mean, it's a big back and forth. It's a very solid back and forth. And at the same time, I want people to understand what was going on, what the stakes are, and what was, you know, basically that.
Well, I mean, first of all, as you can hear, these people are just disgusting, vile, you know, ugly, misogynist, America first. And Revolution Books is the opposite of all that, right? And fighting for a completely different world, which is why Revolution Books has been targeted. These attacks on Revolution Books actually started in the context of attacks on UC Berkeley, and Revolution Books is right next to the campus. So these fascists have been marching from the campus to the bookstore. And I think it's important to step back a little bit and think about, you know, how revolutions have happened throughout history and how even big social changes have happened. And, you know, the role of youth and students in these kind of movements for any sort of better world. And, you know, this is actually why these college campuses have been targeted by these fascists, you know, and this is something that's been going on for a couple decades. You know, there have been attacks on ethnic studies. There have been attacks on affirmative action. There's been efforts to transform these college Republican groups into basically reactionary foot soldiers for fascism, snitching on any sort of leftists or radical professors, targeting students of color on these campuses, and promoting all kinds of white supremacy and misogyny in the name of quote-unquote free speech. And all of this has really taken a leap in the last couple years under Trump, where we've had people like Ben Shapiro, Milo Yiannopoulos, Ann Coulter, Steve Bannon actually coming up on these campuses and speaking in the name of quote-unquote free speech. But their real goal is actually to facilitate, to further clamp down of critical thinking on these college campuses as part of the larger fascist clampdown in society. And I just want to take a minute to just say, you know, they've claimed the mantle of free speech and the free speech movement. But, you know, the free speech movement was never about the right of any fascist to come on, or racist to come on college campuses and spew their venom. It was actually about the right of students at that time to stand up against racism. You know, it was actually started, and you could read about this if you go on RevCom.us, and Bob Avakian, the leader of the movement for revolution that I'm part of, was actually part of the free speech movement. That's where one of the places he first got his political start. And he talks about this was started by people who came back from the civil rights movement who were standing up against racism. It was about the right of those students to stand up against the injustices in society. And now this has been claimed by these fascists to come onto the campus. And part of what happened is Milo Yiannopoulos, who's, you know, one of these intellectual operatives for Donald Trump, came to UC Berkeley in 2017, and students, recognizing the danger that is posed by Trump and this whole movement for fascism, actually righteously protested and shut the event down, and, you know, which ended up causing two things. One is that Trump immediately tweeted that UC Berkeley should be defunded if it can't guarantee the free speech rights of people like Milo Yiannopoulos. And this caused the university to basically completely capitulate to this. And at that point, from that point on, anytime these fascist speakers would come onto the UC Berkeley campus, the university would essentially militarize the campus, and in the name of protecting the free speech rights for these fascists, would suppress the free speech rights of the people protesting against fascism. And I know here in LA, there's a big case, an important case of three UCLA students who actually were arrested for protesting against Steve Mnuchin, Trump's Treasury Secretary. But the other thing that happened after this is that all these fascists, essentially stormtroopers, these neo-Nazis, these white supremacists, these Proud Boys, these people calling themselves Western chauvinists, which is basically another word for white supremacists, started rallying at UC Berkeley and started rallying in the city of Berkeley, instigating fights. This was a major assault on critical thinking. It was a major assault on the whole legacy of Berkeley and everything that Berkeley represents. And then as part of all this, they started targeting Revolution Books. You know, and they're targeting Revolution Books, first of all, because supporters of the bookstore have been on the front lines of opposing fascism and standing up against these people, but also because of everything that Revolution Books represents. And we can talk more about that.
Yeah, I want to actually, and I wanted to actually a couple of other things as well. I mean, one of the things is that you're talking about, it's very heavy because, you know, there's all these things about the, you know, these events that have happened. I mean, this has been going on. People need to understand this has been going on for quite a while. And in relation to, you know, like you dug into going back to what was happening in Berkeley in and the attacks on the bookstore at that point and on people who were standing up against the Nazis, mm-hmm. you know, and that's extremely important. But this is not like it's gone away. It's sort of disappeared. There's actually been a continuum of attacks specifically in many ways, even if it's in the midst of, you know, other bigger events. But when the bookstore goes out to places, when they go out to events, when they refuse to hide behind the wall of the actual store, but you know, they go out and they bring the store to people, and they have all kinds of things going on at the store, and each time they've got to take into consideration the reality that these Nazi dogs are going to come in or could come in and cause serious damage. You know, this is a huge thing for people to be facing, and I think it really speaks highly of the fact that why people do this, how they understand what's at stake here.
Yeah, you know, there's been over 10 attacks on revolution books in the last couple years. Imagine like 50 or 100 Trump supporters wearing MAGA hats, marching through Berkeley, going to revolution books, banging on the glass, screaming USA, USA, die communists, the kind of things that you heard in the video, right? We should think about what time it is in America where this is actually happening, you know? And it does conjure up the images of Nazi Germany and the book burning. And if people are familiar, Kristallnacht, right? The night of broken glass where Nazi stormtroopers rampage through Jewish neighborhoods, destroying Jewish businesses, right? This is what's actually happening. These people have assaulted people. At the same time, I do want to say, you know, revolution books will not be intimidated by this, you know? It is a serious threat, and we can talk more about how serious it is, because it's not just these fascists. It's part of a whole fascist clampdown on society that involves state terror. That's what fascism is, right? It's the combination of state terror from the highest levels of government, right? And, you know, the changing of the laws. We've seen this in relation to, I think you're going to be talking later today on this show about the laws changing in relation to immigrants. You can't even get asylum anymore. You know, you can't get TPS. You know, they're building a wall on the border, all this stuff, right? Along with changing the laws around women's rights to abortion, getting rid of environmental protections, eviscerating the separation of powers, the separation of church and state. So there's all this from the highest levels of government, but there's also the unleashing of that extrajudicial violence, the terror from these Trump's social base, which really should be called a fascist social base, which we've seen in Charlottesville, which we've seen in El Paso and Gilroy. I mean, this has been a horrific summer of white supremacist violence against people all across this country, both from the Oval Offices and from the muzzles of AR-15s. But again, we will not be intimidated by this, and we're, you know, intending to actually turn these attacks on revolution books into even more of a reason for people to actually support this bookstore, which it is a precious place. You know, it is a place that you won't find anywhere else. It's a place that is the, you know, intellectual, the political, the cultural center of a movement for an actual revolution. And, you know, at the core of the bookstore is the new communism that's been developed by Bob Avakian, which is based on, you know, an understanding of Marxism and the breakthrough that Karl Marx made in terms of understanding of capitalism and how it works. But even more importantly, the fact that capitalism is a system that came into existence at a certain point of history and can actually go out of existence through this kind of revolution. So Avakian's built on all that, but also broken with some elements in Marxism that were unscientific, you know, and he's put the whole project, made it more scientific and more radical and more liberating. And part of this is a deeper understanding of the relationship between knowing and changing the world. You know, one of the things I really like from Andy Z, who's the spokesperson for Revolution Books, he gave a speech after one of these attacks on the bookstore, where he made the point that Revolution Books takes both parts of its name very seriously, revolution and books, you know, and you know, there's a basic and fundamental thing about this revolution, which is that it's not some kind of utopian ideal which we're just trying to impose on society. It's a revolution, you know, whose basis and need comes from an actual analysis of the system and how it works, and the possibilities for change that lie within understanding that reality. And all the books and revolution books, you know, help us understand that reality. And if you go into the bookstore, you'll find there's philosophy, there's history that tells the truth about this country and its role in the world. There's you know, African-American literature. There's literature from places all around the world. There's fiction. There's poetry. You know, one of the points that Baba Vakin's made is that you have to have a poetic spirit, and that it's very dangerous to lead a Marxist movement or be the leader of a socialist state if you don't have a poetic spirit, or at least a poetic side. You know, so that spirit really infuses everything that Revolution Books is all about. And, you know, that's why Revolution Books has been targeted by these people who, you know, really don't care anything about free speech, don't care anything about the world of ideas, about the life of the mind, about critical thinking. In fact, you know, these people are all about willful ignorance and blind obedience, you know, and Revolution Books is an obstacle to the type of society, you know, horrific society that they want to impose on this country and on the planet.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Rafael Cadaris, and we're talking about Revolution Books in Berkeley and the attack on it, the threat of attacks and the attacks on it by fascists up in Berkeley. So people should be paying attention to that.
They're planning to march on Revolution Books.
So go ahead, go on with that, because one of the things I wanted to ask you about, I mean, it's, look, you're talking about why the Nazis attacked the store,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it's very heavy. I mean, because it's, yes, it's, there's the political angle to it. I thought the thing that, you know, Andy spoke to was very, very good, you know, and it was, and the thing you were just talking about in terms of that relationship is good. But there's also, there's a reason why the Nazis attacked the store, you know, and to me, it's sort of, you know, it's. It sort of, some of it came up around when I looked at like some of the fight that developed, even, and so you have the Nazis, but then you have the other aspect, the softer aspect of all the reactionary pigs that are in the world right now. And you have this thing going on where people, like, for instance, around this mural question, you know, which mm-hmm. I thought was very, very indicative of sort of both the importance of a store like Revolution Books and the importance of people paying attention to what's being done in that realm. So I wanted to know if you could talk about that a little.
Okay, well, Revolution Books has all kinds of really exciting events, discussions. We're having September 8th. There's a discussion and debate about reform or revolution, drawing from an essay that Baba Vakin wrote about this. We have all kinds of, we just had an event at the store in Berkeley with featuring poets, laureates, and from all over the Bay Area. Another event with an author who wrote a book about, who was a former soldier in the U.S. military and described becoming, turning against the war and against the military. So there's all kinds of events. Recently, we had a really exciting discussion about a controversy in San Francisco. I don't know if the listeners here have heard about it, but because it has actually been covered in the national media, including, I think, in the LA Times. But there's a mural in a school in San Francisco. The school is called George Washington High School, and there's a mural called The Life of George Washington. And it was painted by this muralist named Victor Arnatoff, who, you know, was commissioned basically by during the New Deal era in the 1930s to paint a mural, you know, about Washington's life, you know, and in an act of subversion and anti-racism, he actually decided to paint some reality into this mural and actually painted images of Washington, like overseeing enslaved Africans actually picking cotton and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And he also depicted Washington ordering the slaughter of Native people out west. And this is actually true about Washington. And he was painting it at a time where most people, all they knew about Washington was that he never told a lie, you know, and was the founding father. And he wrote the Constitution, you know, was part of writing the Constitution and all this. So this was very subversive. And what's actually happened is, you know, some people in San Francisco actually made a whole campaign out of erasing this mural, particularly these images of slavery and genocide, because, and this is their rationale, these are people who consider themselves liberal and anti-racist, but they actually said that depicting these images traumatizes students, you know, and this is just ridiculous because these people, you know, have no problem sending their kids to a school named after a slave owner. They have no problem with the big statue of George Washington that's up at the school, but they don't want, they, you know, paternalistically and condescendingly don't want kids to be exposed to the reality of who George Washington actually was. Do they want to stop teaching that in history class too? I mean, this is, you know, do people, and this raises all kinds of questions. Do people actually need to understand the reality about this country? Do people actually need to be exposed to the reality in general? You know, what about the example of Mamie Till, you know, who actually was the mother of Emmett Till and who was lynched by racists in Mississippi in the 1950s. And she made the courageous decision to actually open the coffin, you know, as traumatic, as painful, you know, as it was to actually see the face of Emmett Till mangled, brutalized, murdered by these racists in Mississippi. She decided to actually open the coffin so people could see that, you know, and see what this country had done to him. And that was one of the big sparks of the civil rights movement. So anyway, we invited all kinds of people to come speak at the store on both sides of the issue, and we had a really exciting discussion. And this is the type of engagement that we have at Revolution Books, and it's why people should actually support and defend this store, you know, which is about telling the truth about this country, which is about digging into how the system actually works and what the capitalism and imperialism actually does and causes in the world, you know, and is also about digging into the solution to all this.
You know, and what you were just saying about what this is about, I mean, I think it's really, and I know we're coming up on our time soon, but I think this is really actually, it's very important that people understand what's being said here, because there's a, this is all occurring at a time when, as you were saying, we have white supremacy, we have fascism, it's in the White House, and sort of, you know, and I know a lot of people going, oh, well, you know, it's always been a, you know, the White House, come on, you expected something different. Well, you know, this is a leap. You actually have a practicing fascist in the White House, you know, who's actually, and this has, this is, and they're making big moves. I mean, his attacks on immigrants, which we're going to be talking about in this next segment. But, you know, those kinds of things, the attacks, what he's doing around the world, what he's doing to the environment, all of these things. But, you know, I kept thinking about, okay, there's not enough people that are stepping up and, you know, stepping out around this. At the same time, you know, there's only a couple of bookstores with the name Revolution Books. And that means there's only a couple of stores that actually, even though there's a lot of stores that do good things, but there's these two stores that actually bring out something that is absolutely necessary in the world today, not for a few handful of individuals, but for the entire future of the world, you know? And I think it's important to talk about that as we begin to wind down.
Yeah, I think that's really important. And you know, at the core of it, Revolution Books actually provides hope for people. You know, not some false hope, some illusion of painless progress, but real hope based on an actual deep analysis of the world and how it can be changed. And, you know, like you said, the stakes of the attacks on Revolution Books are really high. You know, it's an attack. These attacks on Revolution Books are attacks on everyone who actually values critical thinking, values diversity, values science, values poetry, values the life of the mind. You know, and values getting to a world without oppression, you know, and everyone should be concerned about an attack on a communist bookstore in Berkeley, right? And it's which again is not just a bookstore, but is actually part of a movement for an actual revolution. You know, it is part of this fascist clampdown. And I think it's worth thinking about. I mean, a lot of people on this listeners probably are familiar with the quote from Pastor Niemöller, who was a Christian Protestant pastor in Nazi Germany, who said, first they came for the communists, and I didn't speak up because I wasn't a communist. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I didn't speak up because I wasn't a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews, and I didn't speak up because I wasn't Jewish. And then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak up. The question I would pose to the audience and people listening is like, what about you? You know, what about you? You know, first they came for the immigrants, then they came for the Muslims, then they came for women's rights to abortion. Now they're marching on the communist bookstore in Berkeley that's actually fighting for a different world and fighting to stop all this. You know, and way too many people are waiting on the sidelines because, oh, it's not affecting me. And, oh, the only way to change things is by voting. no, no, that's not actually the only way to change things. In fact, the only way that things have ever changed is by people stepping outside of business as usual, politics as usual, and taking to the streets. Why are people not acting the way in this country the way that they did in Puerto Rico? You know, flooding the streets and not leaving until the governor is forced out. Why are people not doing what they're doing in Hong Kong right now, taking to the streets, right? You know, what's it going to take for people in this country to do that? And these are the kind of conversations we have at Revolution Books. So I'll just end by saying, you know, it's really important for people to actually stand with Revolution Books, to defend it, to support it. And all weekend long, there's a whole book sale that people can come in, learn about the store, support the store. People should go to revolutionbooks.org. That's revolutionbooks.org. Make a donation to this bookstore. It's an all-volunteer collective that's you know, can only survive and thrive with your support. If you're in Berkeley, or if you have friends in Berkeley, let them know to come and be there on Sunday when these fascists show up, and post about this on social media. Send a statement to the bookstore about why you support the store and oppose these fascists.
This is important, folks. This is one of the most important things that we can talk about in the world these days, what's happening to, basically what's happening to humanity and all of the different ways it's expressed and what it raises for all of us in terms of what we're going to settle for, what we're going to stand up against. Are we going to have a future, and are we going to play a role in having that future and bringing that future into being, or are we going to sit back and pretend that we just never knew anything, okay, then just disappear into the wind? All right, so we're going to take a quick break. That was None of Us Are Free by Solomon Burke. I want to go to a piece that I thought I wanted to run right now from because I think it's very significant and it relates a lot to what we've been talking about. It's called What If, and it's by Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And it's from the film Revolution and Religion, The Fight for Emancipation and the Role of Religion, a dialogue between Cornel West and Bob Avakian. It's 6 minutes, so stick around until we get through this, and I think you'll really appreciate it.
Many people say we need religion to be able to endure, to survive, to keep from going crazy, to continue to struggle on, even to have some moments of joy and glimmers of hope in a world full of so much cruelty and brutality, heartbreak and heartlessness. But what if the world doesn't have to be this way? What if we could live in a world where never again would a parent have to fear for the life of their child just because of the color of their skin? What if we lived in a world where never again would that soul-wrenching experience that never leaves of having to bury your own child whose life was stolen by a brutal thug with a gun and the backing of the powers that be? What if being black no longer meant living in a white supremacist society that continually assaults you in your very being and very sense of worth, constantly subjects you to terror, openly or in more subtle ways, and forces you to face the constant danger that you or your children will have your life snuffed out at any moment for doing nothing but being? What if your humanity really mattered and were considered precious? What if this were true of all people of color and of immigrants? What in fact, if all people were just people of different colors, and there were no distinctions and discrimination and persecution and brutality based on what nationality or race you were? What if there were no such thing as immigrants? What if we all lived in a world community of human beings without borders and tanks and guns and planes to enforce them? What if women could walk down the street and look every man they encounter straight in the eye and fear nothing and not be made to feel? And not be made to feel that you're on display and to be evaluated by how you sexually titillate them. What if no more women were ever again battered, raped, assaulted, denied the right to control their own body? What if people who were different in their sexual orientation or just in the way they went through life, instead of being discriminated against and bullied, were valued for their difference? If that were seen as part of the great diversity of humanity? What if there were no more one part of society exploiting the others, and those exploited had no choice but to enrich them in order to be able to live themselves, working their whole life away under conditions of this ruthless exploitation? What if we didn't have to live in a lopsided world where a small number of countries have accumulated tremendous wealth by exploiting the great majority, and the conditions of the great majority are desperate? Look at the world. Look at the phenomenon of Ebola. There's been a lot of concern about Ebola, rightly so, but way too much hysterical fear about whether a few people here might get Ebola, and not nearly enough concern about what is happening to the people in Africa. What if there were no more wars for domination and plunder? What if there were whole different relations among people, valuing each other's humanity? What if there were different relations to the environment, protecting it and providing for future generations instead of despoiling and ruining it? What if we could have a whole different outlook on life and on the future instead of one of dread and one of desperately striving just to make it? Now, to paraphrase John Lennon's song, Imagine, you may say I'm a dreamer, but this is not just a dream. It is something for which there is a definite basis in reality, and it is up to us, together with people throughout the world, to make it a reality.
All right, that was Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and it's a piece that someone put together a little while ago, and I think it's a very powerful expression of what's going on in the world and what we need to be doing. The questions posed for people, posed for all of us, and what we need to be doing in the face of this. And you can get a link to that on my Facebook page. All right, so look at that, and you can go to revcom.us and find it right there too. So definitely check this out. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned. Quick, but I just had to play that because it always just like amps me up, all right? And even when I go to sleep, now this is weird, when I go to sleep at night, I play that really loud, okay? So nobody likes to be anywhere near me when I'm sleeping. Okay, there you go. You know, I read something just recently. I was looking for something to speak to the horrors that we're living in right now, the horrors of the times, and as well as the possibility of what we can be doing about it. And I came across someone, her name is Talila Lewis, and she's an attorney and organizer and educator who helps people understand the inextricable links between racism, classism, ableism, and structural inequity. She recently wrote that Trump's rule attacking disabled and low-income migrants has a violent history, and she lays out a very good and much-needed critique of what's going on here, okay? So I want to welcome her to the show. Talila, welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Sure. Now, you've pointed out that on August 14th, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security published its final public charge rule. And I think it's safe to say that most people in the U.S. have no idea of what this is. So what is it and why is it so important?
Sure. Well, in brief, the policy would allow the United States government to deny permanent residency to migrants and visas, et cetera, to migrants who, and I quote, are likely to rely on public benefits. And that is as per Department of Homeland Security, USICS. So their officers would get to make those determinations. The determinations are made based on a number of factors. All of the factors on their face are racist, classist, and ableist, meaning they innately discriminate against people who are negatively racialized, so Black, Indigenous, Latinx, people who are disabled or elderly, and also people who are low or no income and working class people.
Mm-hmm. And so here's the question, though. What exactly does this mean for people? I mean, we have millions of people, millions of immigrants in the U.S. right now, millions of people who are, you know, have been living here and, you know, lived through all the horrors that this system could bring down on people. Big point is what was done to Black people and in terms of slavery and including afterwards the carryover from all that. You know, let's talk about this. What does it mean? You know, the definition of what to makes a person, you know, well, put it this way. What does it mean for millions of people in the world right now to be facing this and then coming up against this thing? What is it that the government is doing that is just so reprehensible and criminal in relation to all this?
Well, yeah, I think first we have to begin with the history of this nation. There's a lot of people touting very tired and false slogans about the United States being a nation of immigrants and that we, you know, set up our immigration policy to welcome people from other countries. And while that sounds wonderful, and I think in the perfect world that would be what we would hope our ideals would be, and maybe those are our ideals, that is just not what has happened in actuality. So immigration, as we know it, wouldn't even exist if not for white settler colonialists. And that's part of what I get to in my article, is that these notions of migrants being immigrants and being able to label people, classify people as illegal, literally only came up because white people engaged in mass genocides of indigenous people, appropriated millions of acres of land from those same people, and then stole black people from various countries, including the continent of Africa, and forced them to work for free on forced labor camps. And so I only say that because I feel like that's the backdrop with which folks need to really operate, or else we're doing injustice to the history of the nation. Hmm. And you asked about how reprehensible the current violence is. You can't understand the current violence without understanding the past violence. It's kind of I talk about it as an unbroken chain of violence, first against black and indigenous peoples, and now against indigenous and black peoples yet again, with precisely the same language. So what we're looking at is the Trump administration has added five additional programs, and these programs are essential for health, nutrition, housing, basic sustenance for people to survive, to the list of programs that can be looked at when these government officials are determining whether or not these people may or may not become a so-called public charge. Obviously, you know, if you're forcing people off of basic housing and nutrition, we have a problem, because you're quite literally asking or demanding that people choose between, you know, suitable living and housing, et cetera, and nutrition, versus having good outcomes on immigration petitions, which at this point, you know, the United States being implicated in all manner of violence against the entire global sphere, we really don't have much moral or legal authority to designate people as illegal and ban them from having, you know, freedom to move and freedom of housing and other security.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Talila Lewis, and we're talking about her piece that appeared in my mind is just going blank here. Appeared in Truth Out. All right, now let's talk about this. There's a couple of things that you got into that I was really, you know, kind of, when I read your piece, I was kind of really, it drew me in a way that is, I really wanted to understand more deeply what actually has been happening with all this, because we're looking at now that, you know, you have a situation, and you mentioned this about, you know, different people and the different experiences with all this, but there's these public charge rules, the fact that there's the roots in slavery and colonialism, and then its relationship to immigrants who are now being faced with this as well. You know, I mean, you have the past of what was done to black and native peoples here in this country by the system that was getting set up as the free system of the world. And at the same time, as it goes on and on and on, it doesn't stop with the oppression of black people. It doesn't stop doing the repressing of black people and the horrifying, you know, basically the fascistic ways that black people were forced to live in ghettos and all this other stuff, and under the hands of the police, under the guns of the police. And then it brings into a whole new pack of people, which is the immigrants coming in from, you know, Latin America, from other parts of the world. This is an extremely important thing for people to understand what's the character of what the U.S. is doing and where to come from.
Sure. Yeah, it's really important. I think I'll just kind of expand a little bit about what the public charge laws used to do. The modern public charge rule that we're talking about that has been implemented by the Trump administration was quite literally born out of American public charge laws that strictly limited the population numbers and movement and behavior of black enslaved people. These laws restricted white enslavers' ability to free, or the word was manumit, manumission was the formal term, both healthy and so-called self-sufficient black people, as well as elderly, sick, and disabled people. The public charge law quite literally uses the exact same language, or our modern rule uses the exact same language that says black enslaved people cannot be freed unless they commit and prove that they will not later become a public charge. Every single colony and every single state thereafter had their own public charge laws. Some of them required that black people remove themselves immediately from the colony or state after they are freed. So again, that's forced familial separation, in the same way that we're seeing that with our modern migrants. There was the public charge bond back in the day, as well as at current. There is a public charge bond that if the U.S. ICS officers determine that migrants of today will become or are likely to become, as the language was used, public charges, then they can pay a very hefty public charge bond. That was precisely the same language, precisely the same process used for enslaved Black people and manumitted Black people. So nothing has changed down to the very language that's being used and down to the cruelty that we're looking at.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things, too, that you write about, boy, there's so much we could have talked about. Maybe I'll have you back again sometime in the near future to talk about this. But, you know, there's so many things here. And one of the things that really struck me is you wrote about how U.S. immigration policy now legitimates, and has in the past, but it legitimates dangerous eugenicist ideas about the inferiority of immigration exclusion, targeting groups, the superiority of the drafters of these edicts and all their ilk. But that basically there are sections of people that don't have that in the eyes of all this and in what's being put forward realistically, and when you dig out, when you peel away everything else that they're talking about and how it's not this, it's not that. Although even today, when you see Trump's you know representatives standing up and laughing about what's being done to immigrant people now, let's talk about this. You made a point that basically this situation, U.S. immigration policy today, legitimates dangerous eugenicist ideas about inferiority of immigration, exclusion targeted groups, and the superiority of the drafters of these edicts and their ilk. I think that's really important for people to understand.
Sure. I mean, what we're seeing now is a global neo-Nazi resurgence, right? This is a very organized, very well-resourced movement, white nationalists around the globe. And you cannot deny that the policies, strictures being set up by Germany, by the United States, by a number of countries that are targeting negatively racialized people, indigenous people, low and no income people, and disabled people alike, are quite literally sending messages and kind of creating the strength in the cycles of violence that we're witnessing. So let's not be confused by the uptick in violence against Black and Brown Latinx people that somehow is disconnected from the violence that we are seeing that is coming brought by the state. All of these are part of the same political project, and until we're able to name these as such, we will continue to allow this violence to recur and recur and recur. And if we are not honest about the anti-Black and anti-Indigenous histories of the current present state, we again will continue to allow these injustices and terrors to endlessly recur.
Mm-hmm. Now we have time for one more question, and I wanted to ask you this. I think it's fairly important. You know, you've been talking about a lot of this as we've been talking with each other. At the same time, there's this question of the immigration exclusion policies. I think you've written this. The immigration exclusion policies inform legal and extrajudicial violence in service to the state and what it's doing, you know. And I think it'd be really important for people to understand this. This is not just a lot of people look at it and they say, oh, yeah, it's the South or it's this or it's that. We've been there before. There's just all these, you know, insane knuckleheads going around saying all this stuff. But there's actually a problem where you actually have everything you've been talking about. And I think your point about fascists was actually very well taken and really needs to be in everybody's mind as they're thinking about this and observing what's going on and deciding what they need to do about it, because there's so much that people are not doing today, but there's a hell of a lot at stake here. And I think it'd be good to, you know, to talk about that for the last 4 or 5 minutes that we have.
One of the biggest problems that I've noticed in people who are making efforts to try to address some of the violences that we're witnessing and some of the kind of injustice being wrought upon migrants, Black folks, Indigenous folks alike, is the failure to understand the connections between racism and ableism and classism. What we know is that the moment that the United States government and other governments label a group inferior, the moment that they target these same groups with policy, etc., there has to be something to then come along to legitimate the violence that's happening. Because we're humans, this is the same thing that happened to enslaved people, right? So all of a sudden you found people saying, oh, it's okay that we enslaved and are brutally beating and working these folks to death because they're inferior anyway. See, look at their reading scores. See, they do much better when they're under the strong arm of white men, right? The same thing is being utilized here. And so if you actually understand history, you see that racism and ableism have always been inextricably connected because those in positions of power have needed it to be so. It is the way to legitimate and justify the violence that's being wrought upon various communities. And in that way, eugenics is this idea that there are inherently inferior and superior beings and traits and characteristics of groups of people based on race, ethnicity, ability, and disability, et cetera. And those things are utilized to pit communities against one another. So that's why you see a lot of people saying, you know, let's protect migrants because they don't have a criminal history. But what we know is that time in memoriam, people have labeled all manner of things criminal. It's quite literally a construct, and dropped people into those categories for the sake of arguing that they are inferior criminal. If you look at our disenfranchisement laws, people who were deemed disabled and people who were deemed black or women were all put into the same category, and the same reasons were used to justify their inability to vote, right? And so, and that's just one example. I could quite literally give you hundreds. But that's how we've always seen ideas of disability, so-called delinquency, and so-called dependency being used in the United States against negatively racialized people, and we really have to push back against that.
And one more quick question. I know it's unfair, but where do you think we're at now in relation to all this?
I think we have a lot of work to do.
Touche.
And I think that's a good thing. It's the gift of accountability, and we all need to really be willing to talk about these really hard truths. We need to address these contradictions that our country is built upon. That is the only way that we're going to get to a place of peace and freedom and liberation.
Mm-hmm. And getting rid of a society, getting rid of a system that lives and thrives can only live and thrive on the terrible suffering of so many people. It's just I have to say, reading your piece really was, and you know, and I've studied a lot of around these issues, and reading your piece was really a helpful insight into all that's going on here, and really a call to action for people to stand up and do something, because this cannot be tolerated. And we're seeing this, you know, when you look at these kids that have been, you know, The kids who have died in concentration camps here, you know, and what's happening to, you know, people who are just trying to come up. If anybody's ever been in the midst of this, seeing people and talking to people about what actually happens to them in their own countries, and they're just trying to get someplace where they can actually stay alive. Mm-hmm. And to watch this, mm-hmm, is just not just heartrending, but it should be enraging to all of us.
That's right. Yeah. And I think you hit the nail on the head. These are folks who are quite literally fleeing economic, political, and environmental turmoil that in most cases has been caused in large part, if not purely, by the United States government itself. And if we refuse to name that, we are also implicated in the violence that's occurring. Mm-hmm.
All right, Talila Lewis, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, and we'll stay in touch. Take care now.
Take care.
All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Talila Lewis, an attorney, organizer, and educator who helps people understand the inextricable links between racism, classism, ableism, and structural inequity. She recently wrote that Trump's rule attacking disabled and low-income migrants has a violent history. All right, so now, basically, I want to do something. I want to just tell people, look, we're trying to really, really get this show onto a whole other level, all right? And I think it's part of what is being called for by not just what's happening, the sort of really enticing stuff that's going on, but I think there's a real need for people to write to mslate@themichaelslateshow.com and let us know that what you think of the show, and let us know what you would like to see on this show. Let us know that what you're thinking about is on the show. And that's basically what we have to get this done. I really want to have a connection with people about the next stage, the next step up that we're doing, how we're going to advance this in a world that is threatening the very existence of humanity itself and the planet. We need to actually be stepping out even bigger and better than we have been. All right. So people want to write to me, they can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com, and let's get a dialogue going on about where we're going to go. All right. All right, so that's about it. And I want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in today. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, and the amazing, always amazing Kiana. There she is, and she's just looking and saying, yep, that's it. And Jeff, I got you, man. You get it. So I want to thank all of you folks, and let's go out now with a little pizza I always like to play here, all right? It's Jimi Hendrix.
There must be some kind of way out of here, said a joker to the thief. There's too much confusion, I can't get no relief. Businessman there, drink my wine. Plowman, dig my earth. None will level on the mine. Nobody of it is worth. Let's get it.